I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matt DeWar is our guest this hour. Matt gave a TED Talk recently titled, Being Well Means Not Wasting Time. That's part of what Matt teaches in his high school humanities and wellness classes at Lake Forest High School in Illinois. And his first teacher, well, he's had more, but one of his important teachers may have been his mother's father, his grandfather. More on that in a moment. Matt's master's degree is in curriculum and instruction for health and wellness education. He has a PhD in philosophy of education, focusing on curriculum and wellness theory. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Education and Well-Being. He lived and trained in a Zen Buddhist monastery in South Korea. He still does sitting meditation on his own and teaches mindfulness meditation for stress reduction in his wellness classes. Our most valuable resource, time, is non-renewable, and only when we begin to understand what it means to be well and live accordingly. So we have a lot to talk about with Matt, and I know that many of you in the audience are interested in this search for meaning. I remember reading Frankl's book when I was in high school, Man's Search for Meaning, and how important that was, and how important it is that Matt believes that we need to teach our students, teach our children, not only about how you get a job and how you make money, but how you find a purpose in your life. And he's dealt with some very traumatic situations at his high school, too, which taught him that we need to find meaning. And for some people, it's urgent that we find meaning. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Matt. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and you can find us there at K Dunn Show. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you, Matt, for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. So the TED Talk caught our interest, and you know, it's interesting that you were so young when you started thinking about these profound questions. People tell us that our parents, the last thing they teach us is how to die, but it was striking to me, hearing the story about your grandfather, that what your grandfather, who was having trouble dying, was teaching you was how to live, right?
Correct. It was an interesting situation because he was someone that I had looked up to so much, and he seemed to handle so many things in his life with such ease. And as he approached the end of his life, I could see that he was clearly disoriented and that he wasn't necessarily connecting all the dots.
And he was crying. He was sitting in a chair, and he was crying. Because why? He didn't think that his life had amounted to much, or what?
Yeah, I mean, that was really the definitive moment for me that kind of like just opened my eyes, because he passed away with this nagging sense that he had spent his time, like so many people, living for the next thing, constantly projecting yourself forward, making plans, but without ever actually considering what it means to live in time, and the type of meaningful experiences sometimes we forsake in pursuit of chasing other things like jobs, et cetera.
Like money, right?
Yeah.
And then you found a picture of him when he was a little bit older than you were at the time, and he looked quite content.
Yeah. A few days after he passed away, we were going through his stuff in his basement, and I found this old black and white photograph of him, which I found out that he was fishing in Florida. He was in his early 20s, and he just had this look on his face like he was so happy, and he was right in that moment. And as I sat there looking at that picture, it almost became like a mirror, and I saw myself in his youthfulness, and I realized that he was once how I was in that moment, young, with a whole life presumably ahead of you. And the more I looked at the photograph, the more I realized that he could have never envisioned at that time, I would think, that his life would have ended where it ended, or how it ended, with that sense of for lack of better words, I guess, a sense of an absence of meaning, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so for my 17-year-old self, it was like this big wake-up call, because I, you know, as I looked at it, I wondered, you know, if he could have imagined in that moment in the picture that he would have been sitting in that chair crying when he was 84 years old. If someone would have told him that, you know, how would he have lived his life differently? And so as I'm sitting there looking at the photograph, I realized that the real person being questioned was me. Hmm. And what was I going to do? Because he couldn't do anything, and I could. Hmm. And so that kind of started my search. I became a seeker, I guess, at a young age.
I know you did. It was a pretty heavy thought when you were just 17 years old, though, wasn't it, Matt?
Absolutely. And I remember a number of occasions just kind of trying to shake it off, like it was nothing. You know, like go back and distract yourself with other stuff. But there was something in my core that made me stick with it, mm-hmm. that made me kind of listen to it, even if it was disorienting, because I sensed that something was really at stake for me as a human being, even at that young age. I still knew that this was something I had to address. I couldn't sidestep it. And in many ways, I saw that there might have been times in my grandfather's life where he sidestepped it, and it ultimately didn't get him to a place where he wanted to be. And I didn't want to, I didn't want to repeat the same thing. I didn't want to end up in the same place.
I know that eventually you wound up for part of your journey at a Zen Buddhist monastery in South Korea. Where did you go before that? Where did the path to find meaning take you?
It turned me into a voracious reader overnight.
Mm, really?
Huh. Absolutely. I went from being a very average, mediocre high school student to overnight performing at a much higher level. I was more invested in my learning because I saw my learning as an opportunity to kind of connect to these bigger questions. So I started reading philosophy East and West. I started traveling to throughout the Chicago area, and Chicago has wonderful religious diversity, going to mosques, temples, churches, talking with priests, imams, Zen Buddhist monks, kind of picking everyone's brain to figure out, you know, how these different people wrestle with these kind of fundamental questions about meaning and purpose.
Hmm. And did you find it outside traditional religious thinkers as well? You've mentioned people who are from faiths. Did you find it outside faiths as well?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny you say that. One of the books that had the most profound impact on me was Walden by Henry David Thoreau. Mm-hmm. And there's a chapter where I lived and what I lived for that he goes in depth about waking up in the morning and kind of having this ritual in Walden Pond, and it turns into this meditation about the individual's connection to ultimately the universe. And he does it drawing from all, like Thoreau does, from all these unique sources. And he kind of ends with this conclusion. And I mention it in the TED Talk that we have this ability to, in his words, carve and paint the kind of the very atmosphere through which we experience the world. Hmm. And when I read that line, I remember it kind of rattled me out of a sleep, realizing that there was no action of mine that was so insignificant that it didn't reveal ultimately something about who I was as a person and what I valued.
What did you find at the Zen Buddhist monastery in South Korea?
Actually, from the way you walk to the way you sit to the way you pour tea to the way you eat, that everything is ultimately an expression of what you value. And it was funny. I had a senior monk who kind of watched over me as I was training, and Zen can be kind of militant. And the way it's instructed and taught, and he would always get mad at me for when I would walk. There's a particular way you have to have your hands when you walk, and he would get very upset with me that I would look too aloof walking from, you know, sweeping the porch to the diner or the cafeteria area. So it was this emphasis on mindfulness. mm-hmm. attentiveness. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially in our culture, we have this tendency to overlook some of the most simple things that really make up most of our quality of life. But they're so simple and so close that we often overlook them. Mm-hmm. The way we eat, what we eat, the way we communicate with other people, the way we listen to other people, the way we engage our bodies throughout the day. And it's funny, the more I started looking into it, and I realized this a lot in the Zen monastery, we typically, we're very reductive as a culture, and we want to think that, like, well-being is this particular thing, a pill or a particular diet or something we want to reduce it to. And ultimately, it's not a thing, but the way in which all the things in our lives interact with each other mm. and relate. And it's kind of interdependency. And I think in the monastery, I really started to see that for the first time in a way that I had never seen before. Mm.
And you also, because you've taught at the high school level for some years now, you also write about the fact that what we're doing in this culture is in many ways just the opposite of what you just outlined, of appreciating what you're eating and the moment in which you're eating it and what's happening to you right now. We're talking right now. There are some people listening. We're all engaged. That's one of the reasons I like radio, because we really are concentrated on what is happening now. But you write about, and I'm sure this is true in your school and in so many schools, and you're in a school where you teach high school in a place where people are, many of them, pretty privileged. So people are thinking, even, you know, in 5 years old, what kind of school can I get my child into so that he or right. she will be great at Yale or at Harvard? And the whole future is what we're working for at the sacrifice of what is happening to us moment by moment.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest mistakes we can make, or we do make as educators and parents, is that we implicitly teach our children that those little things aren't important and they can be sacrificed in service to these larger life projects, like getting a good job, going to First Choice University, etc. And I don't think we understand or can foresee the potential consequences of teaching that. It's really a shame, because at the end of the day, again, there is no activity that's so insignificant that it doesn't reveal something about who we are. Hmm. And we clearly miss that too often, I think, in education.
So how do you teach that in high school, Matt?
That is a good question. In my wellness class, we created a thing called Mindfulness Monday. And every Monday, the kids would come in, and we would spend 5 to 15 minutes practicing some sort of meditative technique, from visualization to silent mindfulness to counting our breaths to guided imagery, etc. And many of the kids would say after, you know, gosh, I needed that. I don't get a break in my day. Mm. It's just one thing after another. Mm-hmm. And finally, there's this island of sanity to just be still. And I think we're very much a culture that's addicted to movement and activity. And, you know, kind of going back to my grandfather's talk and this notion of time, I think we've turned time into this commodity that has to be used or it's wasted. And so stillness becomes the ultimate antithesis to that. And from a more existential standpoint, stillness is fertile ground. That's where we most connect to ourselves. And when we're not connected to ourselves, I don't think we're very good connecting to others and connecting to our larger society as a whole. And so in the wellness class, I would try to emphasize those mindful moments. And in my English and humanities classes, in our writing workshop, I have them do writing activities, some of which I actually learned in the monastery in South Korea. Hmm. One is called Focal Moments, and I ask them to write about an experience where there was nowhere else they'd rather be. And then I asked them to write about an experience where there was no one else they'd rather be with. And then I asked them to write about performing an activity or being engaged in an activity where there was nothing else they would rather be doing. And so they would do that, and I would say, okay, raise your hand if all three of those are the same experience. And many times they'll all raise their hand. I say, that's a focal moment. That's a moment where you're pursuing something as an end in itself. It's not a means to some other end. And it, I think that gets them thinking differently about how they spend time, because, again, we're so instrumental with time. It's a means to some other end. And, again, I mentioned this in the TED Talk, that I hear kids saying repeatedly, I can't wait till this week is over.
Right.
Can't wait till this month is over.
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait till this semester is over. I can't wait till senior year is over. I can't wait till I go to college. And they get in this habit of wishing their lives away. And I always say, at some point, you're going to wish you had the time you wished away. And I saw that in my grandfather. And so by helping them become more mindful of focal moments, I think they start to see that there are things in the terrain of their daily landscape that they can pursue as an end in itself, that it's inherently enjoyable, and that it reveals something important about who they are, and it adds value to who they are, even if they can't put it on their, you know, life resume.
Oh, I like that focal moment description, because as you were saying that, it really puts your mind and your life in this really good place too, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Matt,
it helps adjust from, again, kind of just always jumping to the next thing.
Right. We'll talk more about this world that we live in where we are jumping to the next thing all the time. We've got the internet, we've got these devices, these cell phones, and everybody's waiting for the next thing all the time. So the culture in which we live keeps us from those moments, I would imagine, as well. Matt has a lot to say about that. He also has had to deal in his school with students who have really lost meaning in their lives with suicides, which have racked him and, of course, racked the students at the school as well. He writes in his forthcoming book, never in his personal or professional life had he felt so unprepared and inadequate, and a realization that education lacked an ultimate concern. So we will talk about that very deep subject as we continue. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Matt DeWar is our guest. Matt gave a TED Talk recently that caught our fancy, titled Being Well Means Not Wasting Time. And it is part of, he teaches, as you heard him describe, in his high school humanities and wellness classes at Lake Forest High School in Illinois. He talks about his grandfather, he talks about his students, and he talks about his own journey to find meaning in his life, which has taken him to many of the great philosophers in the world, and also as far away as South Korea, where he studied Zen Buddhism. So I guess the question for all of you is, where do you find the meaning? And do you think that we are living in a society, some of the things that we need to use in moderation to keep us from finding a meaningful life? Or the books that you've read that you've found to be particularly important in your quest for meaning? Two phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655 is the number. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, speaking of all those devices, at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matthew DeWar is here this hour, and we're talking about being well means not wasting time, about living a life of meaning. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Nancy in Sheldon, our first caller, Matt. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Kathleen. I have had a father. Had he been alive today, he'd have been 108 years old.
Oh.
And his motto was, oh, I heard many, many times, there's just not enough hours in the day, and be busy and be vigilant of what you're doing. And when us kids were growing up, he would always say, you know, we'd say, he'd give us a job, And then we'd ask him, is it right or did I do it right? He said, you do the best job that you can do at what you're doing. And when you're done and you look at it and you say, that's my best job, then that should be good enough for anyone else.
Hmm.
And he was a reader. Oh, my goodness. We never had television or anything when I grew up and didn't have electricity at the time, but he read. He read the Bible. He read magazines from the Civil War and from beyond, and he was a great advocate of the news, and he listened to the news. He was a very worldly person, and in politics, he was on top of everything.
Hmm. So are you a reader too, Nancy?
Yes, I love to read. In fact, I just finished another one of John Grisham's books.
Mm-hmm.
And I also read the autobiography of Barbara Bush,
mm-hmm.
and I was very impressed with her.
Mm.
Although I'm not a Republican, I vote Democrat, but you know what? It's the person. It's not the political persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I hear your fella talking here about time, time is so precious, and my dad says, don't waste it.
Matt, what do you say?
Yeah, a couple things came to mind. I remember my sophomore year of high school, I had a teacher named Dr. Bird, an English teacher, and I remember him saying he would wear a bow tie every day, and he had all these very idiosyncratic tendencies, and he looked at me one day, and he said, you know, one of the most pleasurable things in life is reading good literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember laughing and tongue-in-cheek back to him saying, you need to get out more. And now that I've gotten older, I know exactly what he was talking about. And I tell this to my students all the time, that with the ever-increasing use of technology, our minds are being shaped, and there's a ton of research showing this, that the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world is being fundamentally altered by the technology that we use. And I think one of the consequences is what they call horizontal thinking, that, you know, you pull your phone out and you go to the main app and then you press that and it leads you to another subset of decisions, and then you choose one of those, and it's this kind of sprawling horizontal network of options. And the same thing with the internet. And what this does is it distorts the way you think, and that vertical thinking becomes less and less likely. And I see this in class with kids in literature, is they immediately want to make the literature conform to the thinking they're accustomed to by using technology. And when it doesn't, they immediately assume that there's no information in the text that's relevant to them.
Hmm.
And so as an educator, it's one of the most difficult things is getting them past that impasse to realize you have to slow your thinking down. It's a mindful moment that we're not going across, we're going into. And that good literature has a depth to it that needs to be uncovered, but it can't be uncovered unless you take the time to slow your thinking down.
Do you ever feel, though, because it is so omnipresent, all of this technology, Matt, that it's a futile effort, that you just aren't going to win that game?
I would like to think not, but you're probably right. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates did not like writing and thought that was going to be a big issue for humanity, and here we are, you know, almost 2,500 years later. And so I think every generation, as they get older, sees what the younger generation is getting into, and we think it's kind of a dire situation.
Yes.
But you're right. There's definitely no turning back. The technology is increasingly becoming a part of our lives. And people often say, well, technology is just a tool. And I very much disagree with that, because it's more of an atmosphere. It's, like you said, omnipresent, that once you engage in the thinking that technology elicits, everything else is colored differently. And so I think that what we can do, And what we must do is ultimately create these islands of sanity, these mindful moments where we can at least open access to a different way of kind of being in the world than what technology kind of offers us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Nancy, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm particularly interested in hearing from some of you in the audience who may practice meditation, practice exactly what Matt's talking about, and describe your experience with that and how it may allow you to go through life differently and maybe in a better way. Who do you think, you mentioned you became this voracious reader literally overnight, Matt. Who do you read and who do you have your students read in your humanities classes that are particularly important?
Great question. I read everything, and that's very vague. Everything from humanistic psychology to Plato. Aristotle, the philosophers I draw most from in my own thinking are definitely Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and probably Martin Heidegger, who was a 20th century philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And in the humanities class, we actually this week are starting Plato's Apology, or Plato's writing the Apology, which is actually Socrates' trial.
Mm-hmm.
And every year the kids really, he's such an odd character for a contemporary 17 or 18 year old to encounter, and they don't know what to make of him. At some level, kids seem to really connect with Socrates because of that strand of civil disobedience and kind of drawing your line
right.
in the sand and,
mm-hmm.
and sticking it to the man. They,
right, right.
They like that. They appreciate that. And so that, you know, often when I frame it in those terms, it piques their interest. But we read all sorts of stuff in that class. We have an interesting textbook called Questions That Matter, and it basically goes through the foundational questions of philosophy. What is the nature of reality? What is the nature of knowledge? And how are we to live a good life, an ethical life?
Mm.
Kids are very much, especially when you get to the ethical moment, they have a lot to say. In fact, we just recently had presentations on modern philosophical or ethical dilemmas and viewing them through a utilitarian standpoint, which is the greatest good. And looking at the ethical dilemma through a deontological, which means just adhering to a certain duty,
mm-hmm.
so that you do what you do because it's right regardless of the consequences, versus you do what you need to do because of the results that it will provide for the greatest amount of people.
Mm.
And it's amazing how invested they become in those types of arguments.
Just the kind of thing you were thinking about when you were in high school, right? And we all remember teachers who would get us, that's the kind of thing that you want, because you're reforming your whole life, right? Those are the kinds of questions you that engage young people.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things as a teacher that I always try to have in the front of my mind is, what was it like for me to be sitting in that chair?
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever forget that, I need to stop teaching. Because I think it's teachers forget that their particular classroom is one step, one part of this kind of conveyor belt of learning for kids, and they're going to all these other different stops throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And even though literature might be extremely important to me, and I can spend all my time on it, to them, again, it's just another step or stop along the way of a given school day. And so I try to, you know, when they come in, approach them as human beings before they're students and tap into when I was 17, 18 years old, what were the questions I was wrestling with?
Mm-hmm.
What were the issues that I had to confront? And harnessing those and channeling them into instructional moments that might shed light on something beyond just, you know, taking a test and moving on to the next thing.
Let's go to some phone calls. We have many coming in. Taylor in Madison. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling because I am actually moving to Madison today, and this is the town that I went to college in, and I had a lease signed, but I did not have a job lined up, so I'm embarking on a very large career hunt. And I love learning about wellness, and I have found through my learning that you really kind of, your wellness can stem from what you view to be your purpose. And it's hard for me to extract my purpose from my career in my mind. So I'm wondering, do I need to find this career and then work on my life balance? Or, you know, I know that's not using my time mindfully, but I'm really grappling with how do you, you know, have wellness in the face of such uncertainty?
That's an amazing question. And I very much struggled with that post-college. I remember kind of wondering, do I jump into something that's kind of close at hand, secure, and will get me moving, or do I pause and kind of wait and feel a number of options out that are more congruent with what I perceive to kind of be my meaning and purpose as a person? And it led to an interesting couple years of trying many different things. And I was lucky to end up finding what I love doing every day, and that's teaching and being around kids. But it was definitely a process to get there. I think the necessities of life vary from person to person, and if someone has the time and inclination and resources to kind of explore different things, then I think that would be great. Go do that. But obviously, if at the end of the day you need to put food on the table, then get a job that you know you can get and ultimately build momentum from that and see where it branches out and where it goes.
It's a big moment for you, Taylor.
Yes, it is. Very, very excited.
Yeah, which is the way to approach the whole thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, all the best to you, and thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Denise next in Moorhead, Minnesota. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I am a breast cancer survivor, and my oncologist was very, very much into integrative medicine. And I told her, I said, you know, yes, I'm going to do Western medicine, but I am also going to, you know, do other things, you know, integrative medicine. And she really, really pushed for mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I think that, you know, that helps not only physically, but spiritually, you know, just and I can't say enough about it. And, you know, just mindfulness and slowing down and appreciating every moment that you have. And it, you can do it. You don't need a wake-up call like cancer to do it. I think it's something that everybody would benefit from.
Matt?
Yeah, that's a very relevant comment, that we don't need to wait for the wheels to fall off the bus or for tragedy to strike to become mindful. And too often, because of the current of our culture, you know, if you're going with the flow, you're drifting away from where you want to go, unfortunately. And as a result, it often takes for too many of us something significant happening to get us to wake up. And pain is often, I had a meditation teacher who said this, that suffering is often life's way of correcting your attention, that when you don't pay attention to something for so long, it often takes something significant to kind of snap you out of it. And that isn't necessary. We don't need that. And I think being proactive and just appreciating moments, like the caller just said, I think that's pivotal. And again, I think it starts with trying to help young people have access to those moments and to value those moments and to tell those kids to also value those moments and integrate them into the whole of who they are, and that they're not things that they should forsake for the pursuit of more socially desirable outcomes like jobs, money, wealth, power, et cetera.
Thanks, Denise, so much for your call. We go to Robin in Madison. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you, Robin?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I just want to make a couple comments. I've been listening to the show. In terms of, I do feel that there's hope for people to disengage from their devices. I think people have to be disciplined about it and make a conscious effort. If I'm going to go for this walk to be able to quiet my mind down, I'm not going to take my phone with me. You know, I think people need to just take breaks because they're all screens. And to think about it as if they're, you know, they're all little forms of television. And we're always talking about how much television people watch. Well, they're always watching something with all these screens. I mean, you walk around Madison, it's almost like a sci-fi
yes, right.
movie. Because you look around and people aren't connecting mm-hmm. to the bird on the wire or somebody's going to bump into them. They're looking down or texting or something.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's turning into the great disconnect and becoming more and more hard for people to just give themselves a break from the devices.
Yeah.
And I did call because every day, you know, I believe that everybody should just live every day mindfully, and I think we're always living in uncertainty. That's responding to the gal who's coming for the job. You know, the job is a doing, but does she need to be a being first and sort of find her way in a new city so that she can really, you know, follow her intuition about what the best job is for herself, you know, especially if she has a little bit of money, even for a month or something like
mm-hmm.
that. I always prefer to do things in that order.
Hmm. Thank you, Robin, so much for your call. A lot of comments on this technology business. I think you say in your forthcoming book, Matt, that we have reached a point where, heck, unless you have to go to class, you don't even have to walk down many streets at all. You can take care of all your life sitting on the couch with your cell phone.
Yeah, it's she's right. It takes discipline, a lot of discipline, and it takes more than that. It takes a plan. I think you have to be deliberate about spaces where the use of technology is appropriate, and you have to preserve spaces where it doesn't blend into there, where you can just be, where you're not plugged in. I think one of the difficulties is that in a technological culture, accessibility is a virtue. People want you to be accessible all of the time,
mm-hmm.
and if you're not,
mm-hmm.
it's a sin against the technology gods. And so I walk and run and do all sorts of things outside, and I'll say, you know, why are you bringing your phone? Just giving people a hard time, and they'll say, well, I feel bad if I don't have it. What if someone needs me? And so we have built into our heads that this guilt that if we're without technology, that if someone can't get a hold of us, that somehow we're doing something wrong. And I think that's a difficult situation to navigate.
Matt DeWar is our guest this hour. He did a recent TED Talk in which he talked about our most valuable resource, time, being non-negotiable. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Education and Well-Being. Matt is a high school educator. He teaches humanities courses and wellness. He meditates himself. He was trained in a Zen Buddhist monastery in South Korea. And has degrees in curriculum and instruction for health and wellness education, PhD in philosophy of education. So how is it that education, which is another part of our conversation, can address the very important part of education, which is finding a purpose and a meaning in life, instead of what career you're going to have, what direction you're going to take, well, what is your life all about? That's the question of the hour. What is your life all about? 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Matt DeWar, and Jerry in Minneapolis is next. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, I'm always good.
Good, good.
Yeah. So, I'm 62, and back in 08, I guess, was kind of the beginning of a downfall, and I've always been self-employed, and things just went bad. And
yeah.
I lost my retirement, some big changes in my life.
Mm.
And now I find myself basically starting over new. My credit rating got hurt, so it's building that back up. I've started a different career, and there's time. I mean, I'm 62, and yeah, I'm not going to retire at 65, but so what? There is time, and I hear and see younger people, 30s, early 40s, you know, it's too late to do this. It's too late to go back to school. It's too late to change careers. It's too late to, well, you know, no, it's not. And actually, I'm finding this time kind of exciting and enjoyable to build something new again. And just wanted to see what your guests thought about that, that there is time for younger people to do things.
Thank you, Jerry. Matt?
He's absolutely right. It's never too late to be present. And whenever you inquire into what time it is, that time is now. And I think that's one thing that my grandfather missed, is that he did have limited time at the end of his life, but he still had the moment to be present. And so the caller's absolutely right that we can't just throw our hands in the air and say, well, The story of myself has been written, and too late to edit or add anything new, and so call it quits. No, there's always time to be present,
mm-hmm.
and to try new things and to entertain new possibilities. And again, it's not always easy, and I think it's important to commit to some sort of practice, even if it's 5 minutes a day, where you can sit down and just be still. And I always say to students, I've never met a person who likes stoplights. There's something about being human. We like momentum. We want to find our groove. We want continuity. And I think if we carve out 5 minutes a day, and we know we can commit to those 5 minutes, we can build off of that and create kind of a positive momentum, and increasingly incorporate kind of a mindful spirit into our lives.
Yeah, we ought to be able to find 5 minutes, right?
I would hope so.
I would too.
And even if you can't do five, do one.
Okay.
Right. It's all about doing what you know you can do and building momentum.
Jerry, thanks for your call, and all the best with your reinvention. George in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Just wanted to call, and I love your comments about never being too old to become present in the moment, and it's never too early either. And my wife is a teacher at Milwaukee Public School Systems, and she teaches second grade. She has yoga and mindfulness for about 5 minutes at the start of every day.
For the second graders, huh?
Second graders, and it just works so great. She sees the confidence being built, and she even sees students all of a sudden during the middle of a class when they're having a hard time stopping and starting to take breaths and being in the moment, which is just phenomenal. So I just wanted to make that comment and how important it is to start them early.
Oh, I'm glad you called, George. Second grade, Matt.
That's amazing, and it's funny. It's funny the way that was framed, because we think of having to teach children to be present at that age, when in reality they are present. If you've ever been around a little kid, they are present. They are in the moment. The question is how do we keep them there? How do we create a culture, a learning experience, an educational system around them that allows them to retain that? Because we educate that out of them. But anytime you're around a little kid, they'll make you laugh because they'll point out something that's so obvious and close at hand that we don't see it. And it's refreshing to be reminded of, oh, yeah, there's something so simple and so interesting, and I never would have noticed it unless this five-year-old kid pointed it out. So I think that's great, though, incorporating mindfulness and yoga into young education, like preschool, kindergarten, et cetera.
Thank you, George. John in Madison. Hi.
Kathleen, I love your program. I don't think there's one I have not loved.
Thank you, John.
I would also like to go back to the classroom and be a student with this young man because he excites me. But his comment early on about Walden, still there?
Oh, yeah, we're here.
Yeah, okay. Walden struck a chord with me because my 17-year-old senior at Verona High School fell in love with literature with a teacher last year, and Walden was one of the books they read, and he engaged his mom and dad, me and my wife, in some conversations that were really quite exciting. Anyway, also your comment about the phone. I occasionally will leave home without my cell phone, and not very often do I go back and get it. And there's almost a relief, a weight off my back when I do leave it. And I just don't worry about it. I'm also reminded of my son. Every once in a while, he'll say he's bored, and I say, well, you know, the cure for boredom is curiosity, and there is no cure for curiosity. And he goes and finds a book to read. But your program is so timely because Paul Krugman, the op-ed writer, had a op-ed today, dated today anyway, Despair American Style, and it talks about the Angus Deaton and Ann Case. Angus Deaton just won a Nobel in economics, and they did a study on mortality among middle-aged white American males, and I'm one of them, and it just kind of shocked me. And he said that one of the problems is the loss, that the white males have lost the narrative of their lives. That they believe in the American dream, but it hasn't panned out for them. And I love the comments of the two gentlemen, the three gentlemen before me. But I just want to know how you would respond to this Angus Deaton study.
Matt, yeah, thank you so much, John, for the call. Matt.
Yeah. We are, in many ways, the self is a narrative, and its narrative is the connective tissue of past, present, and future. And we inherit narratives that our culture provides. And I think he's highlighting a very distinct narrative that I think a lot of people, men in particular, are finding that it doesn't pan out the way it's supposed to or how they were told. One of the interesting things that I've come across is the developmental psychologist Eric Erickson, who had these eight different life stages, and each stage had this core tension between two kind of forces, and the individual has to negotiate each tension to kind of successfully move to the next stage of development.
And on that note, we have to just leave it there because we're darn out of time, Matt. So the eight stages, go look up Eric Erickson. That's your assignment for the end of this. Is your book out yet, or do you know when it will be out?
It will be out probably late April, early May.
Great, great. We'll look forward to it, and we'll chat again then. Matt, thank you so much for being with us. Matt DeWore, our guest this hour, his book coming out, he said, in April, Education and Well-Being. He also has a TED Talk, which, you know how to figure all that out. go to TED Talk, and Matt DeWaar, D-E-W-A-R, was given in June. We thank him for being with us to talk about the importance of time and mindfulness and wellness. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, and to K.P. Whaley for on-air production. We're with you again tomorrow, same time, 1 until 3. Thanks for listening.